Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, where we're exploring the cultures of consciousness. A listener just texted me last week. I think we passed the 200 mark of this show, which is very satisfying. And I continue to really enjoy the experience. And I'm particularly happy that the show gives me the opportunity to meet people at least remotely. A friend mentions a friend, and rather than write them an email and maybe try to get together or have coffee, I invite them on the show. That sounds fun. And then we get to have a conversation, and I get to meet people as well as provide the opportunity for ideas and conversations to slip out into our resonating, overwhelming mind space online and in your ears. And today is no exception. Our guest today is Jonathan Zapp, a character that I've run into, at least in terms of his writing and doings online, although I believe I may have met him back in the day. We'll have to find out more about that later. But we're mostly on. Jonathan's been writing about matters, Jungian dream work, paranormal, and he has a particularly good eye on popular culture, and so he brings that Jungian sensibility to bear on the artifacts of our mad and marvelous society, which has always seemed to me one of the richer opportunities with the kind of Jungian frame, is to use it to look at the deeper meanings and possible meanings of a variety of pop culture and underground culture items. One thing that I'm often a little bit tired with Jungian thought, at least as it's often manifested today, is it's a little old school. It's often a little bit stuck, in the sense that in addition to being kind of the dominant way of thinking about dreams and symbolic transformation for many, many decades in, you know, the sort of counterculture, new age, transpersonal psychology realm, which is fine. But one aspect of that that I've often been frustrated with is there's a tendency to see the archetypes, these, you know, kind of fundamental half animated, half patterned tendencies, clusters of associations inside human psychology. There's a tendency to see them in a sort of ahistorical light. You know, there's the wise man and the fool and the puer eternus, and we encounter them in our dreams, we encounter them in our cultural artifacts, and there's a sort of sense of like, okay, so these guys are about, do they change? Are they part of history as well, or do we always just go back to this kind of, you know, Neolithic template? And Jonathan's most recent book came out a couple years ago and is available online on his wonderful website, Zapp Oracle. It's called The Singularity Archetype. And I really, really enjoyed this one because using the tools of Jungian thought and looking at dreams and looking at pop culture and trying to understand archetypal experience and its relationship to reports of the paranormal or expanded sensory capacities, etc., he brings it into the now, in the sense that the singularity archetype is active in our particular moment, and indeed has something to do with history and transformation and evolution and mutation itself. So it provides a way of kind of revitalizing, to my mind, the archetypal way of approaching things. So I'm really looking forward to talking to Jonathan about that, as well as his super cool Zapp Oracle, which is also available on his website. And I want to bring on our co-host here right now, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. You just had a little run through with the Zap Oracle.
I did. I enjoyed it immensely. And as you know, I too am obsessed with archetypes and what their greater meaning is for us. I think I've probably looked at archetypes from, you know, maybe not every single culture around the world, certainly, but a pretty good handful. Like, I've gotten to know the stories of the archetypes in a pretty good, I think, wide net forum. So when I went on the Zap Oracle, one of the things I enjoyed was not just the accuracy, but also that it corresponded with recent I Ching and tarot cards that I have been receiving. So it did the meta oracle, where it said the same thing as the other oracle. So whenever you have that, like, okay, you're experiencing an archetype, and you're experiencing an archetype, and then it comes through every single forum, then you're like, okay, I need to, like, get to know this archetype. So the Zap Oracle definitely provided me with that consistent experience. So it was delightful.
All right, there you go. That sounds like a ringing endorsement.
Yes.
Indeed. Well, with that, let's bring on our guest here on Expanding Mind. Jonathan, thanks for joining us on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
Yeah. Well, before we talk about the singularity archetype, since we are talking about the Zap Oracle, I'd love it if you could just talk a little bit about how you constructed it, how many archetypes you chose to put in there, how you organized it online. It's an interesting oracle. I think that might tell us something about your background as well in terms of what led you to develop it.
Well, the oracle, in a very real sense, created itself, especially in its origins, which were over 30 years ago, and through a principle that Jung coined, synchronicity, because it was a completely serendipitous, unintentional thing. What happened was, I grew up in New York City, and my parents were always taking us to art museums, and I started this collection of art postcards, and they were just images that were numinous to me. I hadn't heard of archetypes when I started collecting them, but if you collect images that are numinous, they're probably going to relate to archetypes that are activated inside of you. And so eventually I just had a camera bag full of these postcards, and I started putting them on the refrigerator, a few of them every week, with magnets. And then I decided, well, instead of taking the trouble to sift through the cards to figure which cards I want to put up, I'm just going to pick four at random. At least I thought it was at random, and put them up. And then what I started noticing, once I started this ritual of doing this every Friday morning, four cards picked at random, was that the cards seemed to relate to everything going on that week. So I discovered it presented itself as an oracle. And this is why, in order to have an oracle, or you can create oracles out of a number of different things, like, say, the works of Shakespeare. If you just had a one volume works of Shakespeare and flipped through it with your eyes closed and picked a passage, that would work really well as an oracle. And I've tried things like that, because through the principle of synchronicity, an oracle is sort of creating a synchronicity on demand, a parallelism between the inner and outer. So all the outer needs is a seemingly random mode of access, like with the I Ching, it's tossing coins, or with the Tarot, it's flipping cards, and with my oracle, it's the exact moment that you click the mouse or the trackpad turned into a 64-dimensional algorithm to create a seemingly random number that translates into a particular card. And then what you need for that seemingly random process to be choosing among is a set of archetypal signifiers, a variety of different things like the Tarot cards or Shakespeare passages that would refer to classic human states. And if you think about it, every classic human state is somewhere in Shakespeare, like tragedy, love, betrayal, all of that is in there. And so you can use anything that has a comprehensive set of archetypal signifiers as an oracle. But it's important that it not be a one-sided oracle like angel cards. The dark as well as the light has to be represented, as it is in my oracle. And so as I've added more cards, I'm up to 664 now, it's become more comprehensive. And I started with the art postcards, but then for copyright purposes and so forth, I switched to mostly all my own photographs. I've been taking photographs since I was about 12. And I've written extensive text for each of the cards also. And I think
how did you choose the particular titles or concepts around it? You know, like I just pulled one up and it was Exploring Ambiguity and Wary of Hungry Ghosts. These are, you know, they're not the sort of typical idea. They're not easily mapped onto the tarot or the I Ching. How did you develop your own sense of what each particular answer or card, so to speak, wanted to be?
Well, my path of creativity, and it's also an essay and podcast on my site called The Path of the Numinous, is to follow my own obsessions, to follow what's numinous for me. So the way each card came into being is something that was sort of a lesson that was very active in me at that moment. And then sometimes it would come from an image first. Other times the concept would come to me, and then I would look in my photo archive to see what image could represent that. But like so many things that you do that turn out to have a certain universal appeal, it's sort of like the deeper you go into yourself, the more likely you are to find those, rather than if you contrive them trying to like meet a common lowest denominator theme of some kind.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I gotta say I appreciate about your work, is that while you're wrestling with a lot of issues that a lot of people are talking about, you're looking at dreams, you're very much in a certain kind of milieu, reality sandwich, coast to coast, et cetera, et cetera. I also have a sense of a very particular individual and a very specific vibe and very personal questions as well. Like a lot of people seem like they're trying to sell or push themselves into the sort of, you know, babbling media sphere, and I get a very strong sense of a particular personality. And I'm also wondering myself whether that probably has to do with the fact that you're a New Yorker. And when I mentioned, I feel like I've met you. I mean, were you still living in New York in the early 90s?
Let's see, early 90s, I would have been living in Long Island, though I still visited the city quite often.
Yeah, I feel like I ran into you one of these days. But there is something to me about that, and I know you don't live in a city anymore, but I'm kind of curious, how much do you feel like you're a New Yorker, and what does that mean? I mean, particularly, you know, we don't tend to think of New Yorkers in light of spirituality or whatever. These associations are more like West Coast, California style or whatever. Of course, there's a great tradition of very innovative, creative thinkers, mystics, occultists, psychonauts from the city. And I'm just sort of wondering, do you feel that that's part of your, you know, tradition or the current that you come from?
Absolutely. I mean, in my mind, I would guess I would have to say like New York Jew. And I was brought up by New York Jewish intellectuals. And so there's those two cultural forces have kind of merged in my mind, because they're both inextricably part of me, and I grew up into both of them. And I think that the part of it that is a little bit different than the West Coast version and gets me into a lot of trouble with people is a confrontational aspect. It's sort of, I was brought up in a culture of aggressive Socratic dialogue and of wanting to, and of bluntness and of wanting to cut through the more polite veneer over certain things and get at the heart of what's going on. And so I think that characterizes some of my oracle cards, for example, and many other things that I write, is a kind of confrontational bias that I think is very big in New York.
Yeah, and I think along with that, and also something that I noted both in the oracle and your book, is that you have a frank way of approaching the dark side of the picture. And I think this is still something, I like to think it's changing, but I still think this is something that the whole sort of new age world, the whole sort of transpersonal psychology world, a lot of this kind of work is still suffering from an inability to wrestle with the dark side and to come up with a way that both is creatively engaged and acknowledges this side of things. And of course, there's multiple dimensions to it: internal, external, cosmic, psychological, atavistic. You know, there's a lot of aspects to it, but it requires a lot of intelligence, and it also requires a kind of critical thinking. I mean, one of the things about acknowledging the dark side. I mean, in my oracle this morning, I got the wary of hungry ghosts, and I was like, whoa, what's that about? And I kind of dug into your thoughts about what the hungry ghost is inside, outside, in our culture. And it really made me realize that by keeping the reality of the dark forces, let's call them the shadow side, the shadow, in mind, always, that it also gives us a certain kind of critical edge. And that critical edge also has to do with that Socratic confrontational approach that you talk about, that I think is very, very healthy, particularly in a scene sometimes where people are really looking for a kind of happy delusion to relieve them from the responsibility of having to deal with some of the darkness inside and out.
Yeah, there's a lot of unintegrated shadow out there, and it's endemic in the New Age and in a lot of people following Eastern practices, though those practices themselves aren't necessarily shadow denying, but some of the people that follow them are. And at the same time, where people say it's all good and want to kind of brush past the dark aspect of reality. At the same time, and sometimes the same people are also serial exaggerators of darkness. So the postmodern, culturally hip person, it's considered naive or unbelievably amateurish. If you were to say create a movie with a happy ending, it would be assumed that you are some kind of a sellout. And it's assumed that only dark things are cool. And so you have this weird thing where when it comes to personal psychology and people facing their own darkness, they're often very reluctant to do it. But at the same time, and even some of those same people that tend to get very white light about certain things are also the same people that may talk up a paranoid conspiracy view and that may have an unnecessarily grim view of the world, whereas there's a lot of science and statistics. Anybody can watch Steven Pinker on TED Talks and so forth that says we are living in the least violent time in human history right now, with the lowest per capita war death rate. And so there is this kind of going to hell in a handbasket view that you get stereotypically from people. And our nervous system is predisposed to exaggerate the negative because that served a valuable evolutionary survival purpose, and that it's better to exaggerate hazards rather than rewards. And so it's a weird composite in our culture of exaggeration of the negative, but also a failure to integrate the shadow that you find in like the power of positive thinking and this type of thing where there's immense shadow denial.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, with that in mind, I want to bring on the singularity archetype, because that is a very paradoxical archetype in the sense that we can talk about the singularity in ways that are very terrifying for good reason, whether we're thinking about it as a specific technological event, whether we're thinking about it as a point of post-humanity, of the loss and breakdown even of traditional human values, and at the same time, of course, it's one of the most brightly shining visions on our horizon, both for some technologists and also from some New Agers or other people who are looking forward to the possibility of some kind of transformative moment that might hold out the possibility for dealing with some of our global systemic problems or for overcoming some of the shadow sides that seem to be stitched into humankind. So it's already a very rich and complex item, and I would just like to hear you talk about a little about your own kind of discovery of this archetype, even if you want to go back and talk about that chapter you have in the book about your own experience as a kid. And it really resonated with me in terms of the way in which pop culture can let you know about certain sort of deeper paradigms that are going to be operating in your world, in your life, and that the singularity one is clearly something that we're all wrestling with one way or another.
Sure, I'd be glad to go into the way this grew right out of childhood, and that's, again, my path is to take those things that I'm obsessed with. Of course, the one place where people should be cautious about this isn't romantic infatuation. If you were to go into the furthest depths of that, the archetypal depths of it, it would lead you somewhere interesting, but we're not talking about people becoming a stalker or something. But otherwise, if there's something that lights up as numinous to you, and numen means spirit, so something is numinous, if it lights up as having an uncanny significance, then I recommend following that down the rabbit hole and see what you can find out. And that's what I started doing in a more formal way when I was 19. Investigating things that had haunted me from my youth. And when I was 20, in my last year in college, one of the things that was most puzzling and numinous to me were certain sci-fi fantasies in the form of movies and novels that struck me as having this incredible significance that I couldn't fully unravel. One of them was a movie I saw when I was about 12 years old with my dad on a black and white television. It was a black and white 1960 British film called Village of the Damned. And it wasn't clear, but it struck me like a religious vision. And of course, I had seen many, many science fiction movies at that point. But this one had a very unique effect on me. And so did Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End that I read when I was maybe a sophomore at the Bronx High School of Science. And here were what I thought were some of my own most unique ideas written in a novel that was published 4 years before I was born. How was that possible? And it was about the same time that, Village of the Damned came out in 1960 when I would have been 3 years old. So I set about trying to investigate that. And the first and huge hint that I got from anybody was from my mom, who was a psychologist for 44 years. And she said, well, you should look into this guy, Carl Jung, and his theory of the archetypes and the collective unconscious. So I decided, okay, I'm game. I go up to the second floor of the college library. There are all these beautiful black Princeton Bollingen, elegant, you know, collected works of Carl Jung, many volumes. And I see there's an index volume, so I pull that out. But I'm also kind of feeling skeptical as I'm looking at these huge tomes of, like, you know, this guy reached manhood in the 19th century. He's a dead Swiss guy, you know, who died in 1961. You know, what is he going to tell me about my, you know, this weird Jewish kid from the Bronx about my sci-fi obsessions? But then almost immediately I find that, wow, you know, right near the end of his life, he wrote a book called Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. Well, that's a direct hit because these stories in the movie, you know, involved flying saucers right at the beginning of them. And so I pull that book out and I see that not only did he write it near the end of his life, but it's like he couldn't let go of the subject, because flipping through the book, I could see that after the end of the book, there's an epilogue, and after the epilogue, there's an afterword, and after the afterword, there's a supplement. And the supplement was Jung analyzing a science fiction novel that had just come out called The Mid... I'm forgetting the title, but it was by John Wyndham. It was the novel that the movie... it was called The Midwich Cuckoos, I believe. It was the novel that the movie Village of the Damned was based on.
Wow.
So in my first encounter with Jung, he might as well have been a holographic wizard bearing a torch, stepping out of the bookcase and saying, like, yeah, I was obsessed with that one too. And here's what I thought, which had some parallels to where I was going with it. And what was amazing was that his endpoint, basically because, you know, he was going to die soon. And, you know, this was his only published book on the subject, I guess, was my starting point. And so that got me going. And I believe in 1978, I wrote a paper called Archetypes of a New Evolution, which is on my website. And I believe I discovered an emergent archetype that I now call the singularity archetype. And there is a co-discoverer that I didn't know anything about until I started writing my recent book on the subject, or actually was near the end of writing it and was proofing it. And the book is called Crossing the Event Horizon, The Singularity Archetype in Human Metamorphosis. There is a philosopher who's associated with several universities and especially with Esalen, named Michael Grosso, who did his PhD work at Columbia. And he, what I call the singularity archetype, he calls ADE, the archetype of death and enlightenment. But we both relate it to the following things: evolution, death, parapsychology, near-death experience, psychedelic experience, ufological experience. And I've been in touch with him, and we agree that we're talking about the same thing. So I'm not the only crazy one, and there's another Jungian out there who has located the same archetype.
So, yeah, well, once again, I mean, I just want to underscore that what I think, and I'm familiar with Michael Gross's work. He's a great writer, and he's been doing this stuff for a long time. But what I like about this, the concept of the singularity archetype, and even using that word, I think is really important, because it reminds us that the technological singularity that people are talking about is itself only another story or another snapshot or another portal into something that is much more multidimensional. But it is part of the tale as well. But it also brings together a lot of different threads in a way that I think is really productive. Like in your book, you have a full chapter on the near-death experience, which, you know, people usually put in the near-death experience category, and that's sort of, you know, it's obviously has relations with other sorts of visionary experience. But there's a way in which the near-death experience on the personal level replicates or echoes the sort of death and rebirth form on the cultural level, which is in many ways what the singularity archetype, whether it's in science fiction or like the Arthur C. Clarke, or whether it's in technological possibility, is this sense that it's actually happening on a kind of global scale as well. So it's a very handy way to create linkages and indeed a hybridity between these different threads. And then that's part of what the singularity archetype is about. You talk about is about the hybrid. So talk a little bit about that sense of hybridity, of bringing multiple things together as being part of what the meaning of the archetype is.
Okay. Well, my approach to things in general is multidisciplinary, but in this case, it isn't so much about my approach as the content itself. And the singularity has been, at this point in popular culture, co-opted by people like Ray Kurzweil, and is seen through the distorting lens of technological materialists who see it in a very particular way that has a lot of distortions. At the same time, they are seeing part of it, and technology absolutely is a huge player in all of this. In the movie 2001, or the novel, they were created together, which is one of the most complete versions of the singularity archetype, you see the competing themes of streams of evolution, because we have the HAL 9000 computer, but we also have old-fashioned carbon-based mortal corporeal version 1.0 human beings on the spacecraft as well. And it actually turns into, in the plot of that movie at least, a zero-sum battle as to which will prevail, the AI or the organic. And actually it's the organic, the astronaut Bowman, who survives and is the one to cross the event horizon, basically, and is the one that the evolutionary manipulators are most interested in, apparently. So there is this dual aspect in many ways. There's a paradoxical aspect in that every archetype has a light and dark aspect, and I'm very into paradox. My personal philosophy is called dynamic paradoxicalism. But also, it relates on multiple levels to the human experience. And so just like a fractal or a hologram, where the small part recapitulates the whole, the life cycle of the individual is paralleled by the life cycle of the species. Just like that old saying, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, where you see in the growth of a fetus what looks like the development of the phylum of life on the planet. And so what the event horizon in the life cycle of the individual is popularly known as death. The same event horizon projected out into the species is what can be called eschaton. It's a point of fundamental transformation, which could be extinction or it could be a quantum evolutionary transformation. And that's a completely expected event that you don't need any prophecy or New Age anything to believe in, because species have a limited time span. The average is 100,000 years. From a million species, it's 1 million years. And of course, we're working to lower the average. And so we know that our species has some kind of a point past which it's hard to even speculate, because we may either become extinct or change so dramatically that we become unrecognizable to an earlier form. And so these two parallel, and everything that is futuristically projected toward the eschaton, toward the evolutionary event horizon of the species, in sci-fi fantasies and sometimes in dreams and sometimes by technological futurists, is an actuality in near-death experience. So one of the motifs I call Homo Gestalt, it's sort of a telepathic network and a more visual means of communication. Well, this actually happens when people have near-death experiences. They are often greeted by entities telepathically. It's like one six-year-old boy who had an NDE is explaining it and says, and then this light man, this man made of light comes to me and he talks to me, but not like this. He points toward his mouth, but like this, and he points toward his head. So this is an extreme commonality. And then people, for example, in their life review, it's like a telepathic network, because not only are they viewing past events with incredible high-resolution accuracy, and people blind since birth may have visually comprehended near-death experiences, but they are also sort of telepathically, empathically aware of the thoughts and feelings of other people who are in the room with them. So they're now experiencing the same event from multiple points of view. Now, in science fiction, that could be stuff like what happened in the novel Dune by Frank Herbert, where after this advanced sisterhood, the Reverend, the Bene Gesserit, take basically a powerful psychedelic, the Water of Life, and a rite of initiation that kills many of them. But those that survive and therefore become Reverend Mothers now become aware of all the other Reverend Mothers, living or dead, who have similarly passed this rite and are sort of telepathically online with all of their memories and their psyches and so forth.
Well, let me just interrupt and ask you, like, so you're laying down this connection between the NDE and some of the reflections we see in science fiction, and a sense of like some kind of transformation on the far side of the death process. Now, how do you bring that to play with the technological idea of the singularity that is part of materialist science? It's part of our sort of news feeds, our future, the sort of pop futurism of our moment. Do you think that that is sort of an echo of this more psychic possibility, or do you think that multiple things are happening at the same time?
Well, I think that they are representations of the same evolutionary thrust, with absolute parallelism to what's happening on the organic plane. And so, of course, it's not surprising that the most densely interconnected object that we know of, the human brain, would create the most densely interconnected physical artifact that we know of, the internet. So technological evolution directly reflects, until we get AI designing its own technology or something. But at this point, technology, of course, is a psychological artifact. It's a product of the human psyche, and it mirrors our aspirations and our whole evolution, and it's also a key evolutionary catalyst, which I made clear in the second chapter of the book called Logos Beheld, that one of the main things driving evolution forward is the increasing prevalence of visual technologies, and that's a huge theme. So technology is intrinsically related. It's not sort of a separate thing or sort of a competing thing necessarily, and I see it as synergistic and parallel. But maybe I haven't quite made it clear to the audience yet what the singularity archetype is, and maybe it would help to ground it by giving a couple of quick examples of it and how it appears. So, because if we're talking about it in the abstract, I've learned from experience, we might just lose some people who might just think we're talking about the technological futurist version of the singularity.
Yeah, but before we do that, we actually need to take a break right now. So you're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Eric Davis, and we're talking with Jonathan Zapp. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Erica Davis. We are speaking with Jonathan Zapp, maker of the Zapp Oracle. And we're talking right now about the singularity archetype. So before the break, you were going to explain a little bit about what exactly the singularity archetype is. And this is always a situation, like you mentioned, the diagnosis of which archetype you're working with and what is that kind of the differentiation of these archetypes can be quite, you know, a thing. Like you can go and you can find like Isis, let's say. So you can go like, oh, well, here's Mary. Are these guys the same? Is this the same? Are we dealing with the same thing? So you kind of go through and you look at like all the characteristics, you know, like almost like you're on a dating site trying to match up all of the things to like match each other. It's like you said, when you came across Jung's and you figured out, okay, this is the same thing that we're talking about, like you and this other, you know, any other experience of that archetype will have these kind of diagnostic elements. So to help people to really be able to diagnose what it is, the singularity archetype, can you help them to give like their little checklist to look for?
Absolutely. And so it's important that people, because I assume a lot of people in the audience already know what an archetype is. They're demonstrated by empirical evidence. They show up in every culture and every period without there having to be cross-influence. There are things like the shadow, the hero, the trickster, the devil, and so forth. And however, they are not merely patterns that we could reduced to a checklist, even though they have very definable attributes, they're best understood as living agencies. So they are subjects, not merely objects, and they can be said to have their own intentions, and they largely shape us. And no one definition of a particular archetype is ever going to be definitive, because it's just like no one sentence or checklist I could say about you or me or anybody is going to be a full picture of a person. And so since archetypes are entities as much as they are definable patterns, they can't be reduced fully to that extent. However, the basic Jungian method is you look at many different examples, many permutations, you start to remove idiosyncrasies that may be peculiar to just one version, and you sort of clean up the signal to noise ratio by doing that. So I've kind of compared it to, you know, some archetypes have been called great primordial images. So I used to be a diamond grader. If you think about an image, say a holographic image that were inside a round, brilliant diamond, which is a very prismatic thing and confusing to look through, even in a microscope, because you're getting all these prismatic distortions of everything. So with every facet that you look through at that holographic image, it looks different, like a series of cubistic paintings. But after a while of looking at it from many different angles, you start to get a more holistic sense of what it is. And so the singularity archetype is an experience that people have that can be a projection toward the future. It can occur in a dream, in a psychedelic experience, in many different ways that people may actually travel to the event horizon, like with a near-death experience, and there'll be a kind of rupture of plane event, a total shock, an ontological shock, and from the perspective of the ego, it will seem apocalyptic or the worst thing possible. And then there may be an out-of-body experience or something that gains the viewer of it, the perceiver of it, a cosmic view of the very same shock, and what appeared to be apocalyptic is then revealed to be a quantum evolutionary event. And and that may be represented by unusual lights, by eyes, and by spirals. And then they're crossing the event horizon. There are things that start to happen. Egocentric perspective is broken down, and one may become part of a telepathic network. And basically, once any core attribute of what it means to be human changes, you know, all the others are guaranteed to shift, like gender identity, nation state, money, and time. It very much linear time is transcended when one has an experience of the singularity archetype. So to ground this in a couple of quick examples, in the form of three dreams. One was told to me by a young man at a rainbow gathering a few years ago. He's walking in the forest, and the sky becomes becomes completely dark and the earth starts to shake and he's terrified and it feels like the whole planet is being broken into pieces. And then there's a break in the dark canopy of clouds. A beam of sunlight comes down and hits the top of a tree. And out of the beam of sunlight, a golden eagle begins spiraling down. And in its talons is a golden egg with an aura of lights. And it deposits the egg on the top of the tree. The next two dreams are reported by Marie-Louise von Franz, one of Jung's most brilliant colleagues. They were dreamt by, she described as a simple Protestant woman. In her first dream, she is standing on the earth with a spirit guide, and she sees the dark wing of Satan come down and blot out the sun, and it terrifies her. It seems like Armageddon or the coming of the Antichrist. In her second dream, she is seeing the same event, but now she's up in the heavens, and what looked like the wing of Satan is now revealed to be the white wafting cloak of God, and there's a white spiral of light in the sky, and the figure of Jesus seems to be reaching his hand out toward the viewer, as if inviting us to step through the spiral, which is oriented, as von Franz described it, as if it's inviting us into another dimension. So, of course, a religious person sees it through the stained glass window filter of their religious mythology. and now, if I can give a slightly longer example, but you see in both examples, you see what at first seems like dark and threatening apocalyptic is then revealed to be an evolutionary transformative event. In both cases, there are spirals and special lights, and the eagles have the best eyes in nature. But in Arthur C. Clarke's science fiction novel, Childhood's End, UFOs appear all around the earth, and they break through all communications and say, you can call us the overlords. We are here to, we've been sent by a, basically what's, and Arthur C. Clarke was a famous atheist. So you have a contrast to the simple Protestant woman. He's one of the most famous atheists and an astrophysicist, a man of science. But he has kind of a naturalistic God concept in Childhood's End called the Overmind. It's a disembodied intelligence that pervades the universe, pantheistically, I guess. And it's aware of where intelligence is evolving anywhere. And wherever intelligence evolves, there's a certain stage at which it hits a critical juncture where it can create great destruction or there could be great metamorphosis. And when that is about to happen, it sends an extraterrestrial, from our point of view, species called the Overlords, who are incredibly advanced, benevolent, and intelligent, but are themselves, as they put it, barren in that they've reached some kind of evolutionary cul-de-sac. They don't go through this great metamorphosis that some other species do. And so the overlords say, you know, we're here to help, and we're not going to interfere with what you're doing except to prevent violence and through some technological magic, any kind of projectile weapon from a bullet to artillery shells to nuclear missiles is returned to the sender so that organized violence, you know, becomes impossible. They share many technological and scientific secrets, so we have great medical advances. And basically, for the next 50 years, there's a golden age of a unique economic prosperity and so forth. But one oddity about the overlords' evolutionary intervention is they will not appear physically before mankind, they say, for two generations, 50 years. When the 50 years pass, they descend from their crafts, and people are shocked to see that they have great ebony wings and horns and tails. And so this is, they're like the archetype of the devil. And this is odd because here in this atheist-written work in the world of technological materialism, stereotypical of science fiction, is the specter from the Christian and pre-Christian past. And Arthur C. Clarke explains their appearance as a race memory of a future event. The overlords are not evil. They are as benign as they say they are. They're exactly who they say they are. But their appearance, which is just the physiological adaptation to the environmental conditions of their home planet, is associated with evil in the primordial human past because they represent the end of the old genome, and organisms are conservative. It's the end of the old species. And as soon as the overlords descend, they're looking for the first human being that will break the mold, that will be the mutant, that will show that this evolutionary crisis and metamorphosis is happening. And they call that subject zero. It's kind of like an atheist version of a messiah concept. And one of the overlords, Reshevrek, goes to the home of a man who has the largest privately held collection of books about the paranormal. He wants to speed read these just to look for signs of Subject Zero. He sees a lot of them are very poorly written and nonsensical. And the people hanging out at this house who've come for the sort of celebrity name-dropping aspect of meeting an overlord seem, especially for 1953 when the book was published, like prophetic anticipations of goofy New Agers with a lot of narcissism and so forth. And he observes them doing a seance of sorts with the Ouija board. And they ask the Ouija board, who are you? It spells out I-A-M-A-L-L, I am all, which almost sounds like the collective unconscious. And then they ask it, what are the coordinates of the overlord's star? And it spells out the correct coordinates, which is information that the overlords kept secret. And so the overlord that's present, Reshevrek, feels Subject Zero must be present. But these adults all seem kind of mediocre. But it turns out one of them is pregnant, and it's her fetus that is Subject Zero. As soon as he's born, he exhibits all these paranormal abilities, and then all, like a seed crystal, all the children born after him are of this new type, and they form a telepathic network. And after a certain critical number of them are born, the old human species, us in other words, Homo sapiens, becomes sterile, hence the title Childhood's End, because we've sort of fulfilled our purpose now. We're like the chrysalis out of which this new form has appeared. And in the final visible stage of the evolution of these new children that at some point translocate and join like a moving spiral with their hands together, something they call the long dance on one continent, when they are finally going to, in their last visible stage of evolution, merge energetically with the overmind, there's only one human observer of the old type left. He's still around because of time dilation. He snuck on board one of the overlord's spacecraft. So when he comes back, all the old human beings have died off, but he's there to observe it, and the overlords want to see what this evolutionary event horizon looks like to hit through his eyes. And to his eyes, what it looks like is an aurora borealis, a spiral of white light in the sky. So basically, if you think about the correspondence between the dream of this astrophysicist atheist and the dreams of the simple Protestant woman, we have the dark wing of Satan coming down in both and representing the evolutionary event horizon, the spiral of light in the sky. And well, I could go
I can also add, synchronistically, last night, literally, I was going over with my friend all this research I've done into the red dragon of the apocalypse. So almost every single thing that you mention in there is also in the story of the red dragon and the woman. It literally shows, you know, the pregnant woman lifting her child up into this aurora borealis. If you look at some of the old oil paintings, she's lifting up the Christ child, and then the red dragon's on the bottom, which is like, you know, our physical form now. And then it's basically those paintings exhibit in a picture everything you just talked about. So it corresponds with all of those as well.
Wow, I'd love to see that. That's an image? That's a painting I can see somewhere?
Correct. It's of like it's called The Woman Clothed in Sun, and actually the aurora is a specific kind of female goddess. A lot of times people associate the sun gods with males, but when the dawn breaks, that's the goddess Aurora or Astara. She is the goddess of the dawn, which is literally where they get the Golden Dawn name for that entire cult system. And it's the moment where the female lifts up that child, which in Chinese Taoism, they alchemically call it slaying the red dragon, where a female actually stops menstruating and begins lactating, where it raises the energy in that level. But those stories correspond exactly to those dreams that you just described.
Well, it's amazing, but of course, I guess we shouldn't be amazed because this is what archetypes do, is they
right.
pop up everywhere. And
exactly.
So these uncannily specific things are repeated elsewhere to where a naive person might think it was plagiarism or something, but it's actually just the spontaneous emergence of the same
archetype. The other image in those pictures is literally of the devil. Like you said, it's a horned creature that shows up. He's got scales, long fingernails, long toes, and all these medieval images of specifically the red dragon and the woman clothed with sun. There's this other figure who has horns, scales, wings, and big long fingernails and toenails.
Yeah, William Blake actually has a beautiful image of that that moment from Revelation as well. And what I love about the singularity archetype and just the resonances that are just happening, you know, as we speak, you know, the archetype is sort of playing with our conversation, is the way that it oscillates between the personal and the collective, and that you can't resolve it in that paradoxical way. I'm reminded of this Hazrat Inayat Khan quote where he says every man or every person's death is the last testament, the last judgment. And there's this sense of way in which we can mobilize our own relationship with death, with our own inevitable death, and with the foreshadowings that our bodies give us, our dreams give us, our fears, and to some extent our will that we raise in order to confront that with eyes open. And we can bring that same energy to bear on the sense of collective transformation and collective threat that we're involved in. So rather than just being overwhelmed by the news and by the sense of history perhaps falling apart, perhaps, you know, moments of transcendence, there's a way in which we can use our own personal experience of this archetype to kind of create a feedback loop between these different layers of scale.
Yeah, and it helps us to. It's like Stephen Dedalus, the James Joyce's literary alter ego, said, and Terence often quoted this: "History is the nightmare from which I'm trying to awaken." And so, one of the ways of waking up isn't the difficult task of trying to, say, transform everything going on in the Middle East, which is beyond any individual human scale. It would be to be aware of what the dream actually is. And when you understand the singularity archetype, then you see this dream playing out in your own personal time scale and that of the collective. And your own personal time scale, because you can wake up in the dream and understand the mythology that you're living through, often has a much more hopeful outlook than the collective does, because the collective has a kind of lowest common denominator aspect. And so the shocks that it needs to experience often need to be apocalyptic to get enough force to change a system that doesn't want to change. And but with the individual, the conscious individual, a subtle shock like an understood dream or being able to comprehend a mythology can be enough to get you ahead of the curve of change and figure out how to have the right kind of metamorphosis that you need before you head to your guaranteed event horizon called death.
Well, where I just want to really point this out, because it's very important, the difference of the singularity archetype, because there's archetypes that are transformational, and there's archetypes that are evolutionary, right? So there's archetypes that will help everyone within the wheel, right? Like, you'll be in your wheel playing out these myths, and you'll get to know, oh, this is like the Medusa story, and then she'll start showing up with all this. Then it'll kind of like end the same, or maybe like have something happen, but you're still kind of in the cycle of that mythology. And then, like you said, there's these other ones where you kind of like pop out completely and see the whole thing as a play, and then experience a change into a new state of being instead of recycling some of the stories. You know what I mean? So
that's why the central symbol of the singularity archetype, if you look at the cover of my book, there's a spiral with an eye at the center, is the spiral. So if you think about the spiral, it's an elongated circle. So it has a circular aspect in that there are classic stages that people may go through in their own individual experience of it. But at the same time, there is an evolutionary teleology that's not fashionable to talk about evolution having a goal, though Darwin himself was believed in orthogenesis or goal-oriented evolution. And so that kind of extends the circle so that it becomes an interdimensional spiral. And so there are circular aspects. It's just like combining eternity with linear time, because from the point of view of eternity, everything is happening all at once, and that starts to look circular. But then from the point of view of linear time, there is this progression and unfolding and evolution of the story. And so you put those two together, and you have this elongated spiral. And so it does have classical cycles, but it also has a transformational evolutionary aspect where you there can be a rupture of plane and where you cross an event horizon into a world that's so strange that it's like what JBS Haldane said, it's not only stranger than you think, it's stranger than you can think.
Right.
Well, that's wonderful. That also reminds me, you know, we haven't talked about Terrence, but he was definitely been haunting this whole conversation. I mean, Childhood's End was an extremely important book for him. And, of course, he brought these this great resonating multidimensional archetype into, you know, such an amazing kind of cultural play. We just have a couple of minutes left here. And I just wanted to give you a moment. And, again, I'm sure we could go on for hours, but we just have a couple of minutes. But just to mention the pathology or the dark side of this kind of thinking, you know, you talk about that in your book too regarding Heaven's Gate, but really just the traps that people can fall into when they get this particular archetype activated.
Yeah, well, the one of the major pathologies of the singularity archetype is something that was around even before Zoroastrianism. It may have occurred as long ago as the late Paleolithic, and that's apocalypticism. It's kind of a linear time, ego-bound view of the singularity archetype where you think that the world is about to end, and there's a blurring of inside and out because the event horizon, that end of the world, is always imminent for any individual mortal because of death, but then that is projected outward toward the species. So the person perceiving the singularity archetype in this distorted way and kind of looks through a glass darkly gets back an image of themselves and of their own imminent death and thinks that the whole world is about to end. And then may do all kinds of bizarre things that accord with that somehow. In the Heaven's Gate suicide cult, you had aspects of the singularity archetype on a much more profound level where they were trying to they called themselves the form beyond human. They were aiming at an evolutionary metamorphosis. So their pathology of the singularity archetype brought in many more specific aspects than the average apocalypticist. But that's a very popular and destructive brand in the human species that's called Untold Harm. The Book of Revelation is, you know, the most pathologized book of the Bible in that it's caused people from David Koresh to, you know, people throughout history to do awful things.
All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. But word to the wise, as you course through your own singularity rocket ride, beware the pathological excesses. As always, the middle way is called for. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Minds.
Thank you. It was great fun.
Yeah, and folks, you can find out more about Jonathan's stuff at zaporacle.com. So from Majid Amid, all you out there, keep your minds open.